You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've spoken on the show before about jogging during the pandemic, how it can be a form of stress relief. And since it can be done alone and outside, it falls under the category of safe activities under current social distancing requirements. But for people of color, going outside for a jog or any number of activities can sometimes mean what one writer has called an exhaustive mental checklist to avoid a racist encounter or even racist violence. Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, was out exercising in Brunswick, Georgia, when he was followed by two white men in a truck with a shotgun, who said he resembled someone wanted for robbery. The two men in the truck, a father who was a former police officer and his son, fatally shot Arbery. Arbery's family attorney says the Justice Department is now investigating the shooting death as a hate crime. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, four police officers have been fired after one of them held his knee on the neck of a black man named George Floyd, who was pronounced dead at a hospital. And over the weekend, another video emerged out of New York City where a white woman named Amy Cooper called the police on a black man who was out bird watching. He had just asked her to follow park rules and put a leash on her dog. She since apologized and lost her job, but it's sadly the latest example of a person of color going about a seemingly banal activity like birding or jogging that turns into something that is at best unpleasant and at worst potentially deadly because of the problem of racism in America. To talk more about this, we're joined now by Kurt Streeter. He covers sports for the New York Times and is based in Seattle. He published an article last week called Running While Black. He also writes about race, gender, and social justice. Kurt, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate
I'd also like to welcome Eric McDuffie. He's been an avid runner since 2007, everything from one-mile races to marathons. He's also an associate professor of African-American studies and history at the University of Illinois in Urbana. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us on the line from Detroit is Maria Stanfield. She's a psychologist. She's also an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit, an organization that encourages African-American women to get into jogging. Maria, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And if you out there would like to join the conversation, you can always tweet us at 21st Show, that's 21st Show, or join the conversation by giving us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Kurt, I want to begin with you. You write about this, quote, exhaustive mental checklist that you go through when you're headed out for a run, on a run. Can you tell us some of the things that go through your mind when you're preparing to go out?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the first things that that goes through my mind is the fear of being, of something happening, like somebody thinking I'm a prowler or I shouldn't be in their neighborhood, calling the police, and then somehow the police, you know, coming up on me and then things going awry from there, as we've seen happen so many times. That's really always been, where I run at least, my biggest fear. I don't necessarily fear, and I don't really go through the checklist of people coming upon me in a truck with shotguns. Yeah. Although I do know that something like that could happen. But really, you know, it's people who fear black males, black people in the neighborhood that I live in Seattle, Washington. It's first of all, Seattle's one of the whitest cities in America, and I live in predominantly white neighborhood where you know, a lot of really great folks, but they're not really used to seeing black faces around. So when I'm jogging down the street, and if I've got a hoodie or if I'm dressed in a certain way, I think about all this sort of thing, how I'm seen, am I going to be seen as a threat? What's going to happen then based on that? So there's, you know, you think about your clothing, you think about things like, you know, slowing down to, let's say, look at homes that are really interesting to me, or somebody's garden, right? I love stuff like that. But I don't tend to stop and look and take in the what's around me, because I don't want to be seen. There's something in the back of my mind about, you know, the fear of being seen as somebody that's looking for an open door or an open window. And I know that's absolutely just crazy to be thinking of, but or to be worried about while I'm out running, supposedly enjoying my time, supposedly relaxing and kind of in my own meditative state, which is really why I run. I think why so many of us run. But the fact that there's just this constant background noise, and sometimes it's small, sometimes it's often just a small kind of voice in the back of your head. And sometimes, you know, as it was after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, it was really, really, really tough to run in those first few days after that, after looking at that video.
Yeah. And it's obviously not something that a white person from the neighborhood would have to think twice about, I'm sure.
Not at all, especially not where I live. Where I live. I mean, I'm probably literally, I don't think that there's a black male adult who lives probably within 5 or 6 blocks of me. There's very few just in this overall neighborhood. That's not uncommon in Seattle.
Yeah.
So
I wonder,
it's a little different maybe than in parts of Illinois and much of the country. Seattle's a very, very homogenous type of place, especially when it comes to the black population, very, very small black population here.
Yeah. Is this something, this mental checklist and these sort of thoughts you're talking about, has this been going on since you've been running? I mean, did it start at some point? Maybe you can talk a little bit how you got into the sport of running.
Yeah, it's not new at all. You know, I started running. I've always been an athlete. I didn't really enjoy running until I got into it in about 2005 when my dad was dying and he was in the hospice. And I would take time then to go start going on runs just because I needed to process and I needed to meditate on what was happening, figure out how to help him and that pain. And I found it to be, you know, that to be incredibly important to that time in my life. But even then, you know, I'm definitely not, you know, noticing looks that I get, sort of objectifying looks sometimes when you're out there. Sometimes they're not always negative. I mean, they're often not negative looks, but it's a look of kind of surprise. What's that person doing here? You're being objectified and being made an object instead of a human being. It can be a form of aggression in its own right, even when people are smiling at you. You know, it's just. It's maybe akin to what some, you know, women, I always think of how women often feel when men gawk at them. And that can be a part of it. But that's when I started running when my dad was dying. And, you know, I got to say, you know, you're in Illinois. One of the things that's always gone through my mind that I've always remembered is the killing of Ricky Birdsong, the basketball coach at Northwestern, who was killed in front of his children while he was out on a run, as far as I understand, in a Chicago suburb. And he was killed by a white supremacist who came into their neighborhood. You know, since I'm in the news and a reporter, I've always been very aware of that. And I mean, in 2005, when I started running, it was maybe 5 or 6 years after the Birdsong killing happened. But that as I was running, I was thinking of Ricky Birdsong, and I frequently think of that killing. You know, you can just run into a neighborhood and you could by chance just come upon somebody that has less than your best interests in mind and might want to do something like that. Just the fact that happened, that was always on my mind. You know,
yeah.
And I've run all over the world too, you know.
Sure.
My job, I go to Melbourne, or I go to London, I go to where you know, wherever sports might take us. And I mean, I feel like, you know, black people are targets and objectified and worried about really all over the world. And even I have to say in our own neighborhoods, you know, often that's something that's really not talked about that much, but
yeah.
The way that sometimes, you know, in our own neighborhoods, we have to watch our back. It's just it's a sad state of affairs, which I really pin on, you know, white supremacy, and that idea I think's permeated the entire world, and even within our own community to some degree, maybe subconsciously, a sort of sort of fear of ourselves at times. So it's complicated. And
yeah.
Yeah. Race is a tough, tough, nettlesome.
Yeah.
Complicated subject.
It is. And if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We've been speaking with Kurt Streeter, who covers sports for the New York Times. We're also joined by Eric McDuffie, who's a runner in Urbana and a professor of African American Studies at the University of Illinois, and Maria Stanfield, who's an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. Professor McDuffie, I want to turn to you. You run in Urbana, and you're actually, I understand, planning on doing a special running challenge where you run every 5 miles every 4 hours, if I have that right, over the course of a day. And, it being a 24-hour period, some of that is going to be at night. I wonder what's going through your head as you're planning this.
Sure. Well, thanks. Well, first, if I can just begin right quick, I would like to express my solidarity for Brother Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, but also Breonna Taylor, Corrine Gaines, Black women who also have lost their lives to state violence, to white terrorism. I think too often when we talk about violence against Black people, we too often focus only on men. And we have to keep in mind that women and girls to experience this kind of violence. But to answer your question, yes. So I am planning this Friday to run. It's part of a challenge. I'm part of a running crew here in Urbana. And some of my colleagues, my friends, have been running 30 miles in 24 hours. And which means that if I'm going to do that, I have to basically, I plan to run every, as you pointed out, every 4 hours or so, which means I have to run at night, probably at 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. And my parents, actually, who live in the Cleveland area, might be listening to this program, and I wasn't going to tell them about this until after I did it in case anything happened. But, I've been thinking about, should I call the cops and inform them before I go out and run that there'll be an African-American man running through Urbana at, 10 p.m. or 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And I should also note that I was thinking about running with my partner, who is a woman, and given her concern about her safety, it would make sense for her to run with me. But I should also note that she's white. So I'm thinking, right, just where I'm going here, right? So
yeah.
If I'm out at 2 a.m. and I'm running through the dark streets of Urbana and somebody sees a Black man running down the street with a white woman, who knows what kind of phone call could be made. So I've been thinking about that quite a bit, about what I'll do, if I'll call the cops or not. But I have thought really carefully about the route that I'm going to take. I'm not going to run down any streets that don't have streetlights. So I've been thinking a whole lot about this. But in my years of running, I've been called the N-word, I've been heckled, just all the nines, I've seen, experienced.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. We're also joined in our conversation now by Maria Stanfield. She's with us. She's an ambassador for Black Girls Run in Detroit. And Maria, as a runner yourself, are there things that you do to prepare and protect yourself as you go out jogging? What's going through your mind?
Absolutely. And those things continue to grow as we are placed at risk for physical violence, as well as being placed at risk to be hit by a vehicle. Many runners, male and female, begin their runs at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., because they want to run like it's we're in the heat of summer, right? So they want to run at the coolest time of the day. So they oftentimes run very early in the morning. And what that means is, as a Black woman, and any runner would do this, but in me in particular, being a dark-skinned African-American woman, I make sure that I have on my lighted vest. I oftentimes will wear my lamp, my headgear, and sometimes I'll put on some additional lights on my body just so that I know that people see me. But even though I know they see me, it is also when they see us. And what I mean by that is sometimes I know a driver may see me, but they'll still become, and the road is very wide, but they'll still come very, very close. And what some of my co-runners on the call have been speaking to in terms of going to communities that there may not be a lot of African Americans in the community. We don't necessarily know that going into the community, but we do go into communities that are very nice, often in parks, often very, very nice architecture or murals, because running is an experience. And you want to experience the fullness of the environment when you go. So you pick routes that are different. And sometimes when people who are not of color see African Americans, I have been heckled many times. I've almost been hit by a car 3 times. And one time was very bad. I ended up injuring my knee. But there's not just the mental, but the physical and things that you have to put in place to make sure that you're safe when you're out on the run. And then, of course, we know that we are, whether we're running or not, we have the implicit bias. And people make assumptions about us as if our color in itself is a weapon that they have to protect themselves from. And some of the some of my co-runners on the line have spoken to that, just about the disparities and the actual acts of violence that African Americans, both male and female, have come in contact with just because of that implicit bias.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to take a short break here, but I want to continue this conversation. Please stay on the line with us. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We've been speaking with members of the running community about their reactions to the killing of Ahmaud Arbery and their experiences and the exhaustive mental checklists that they sometimes go through to ensure their safety for fear of racist violence and discrimination. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with members of the running community about their reactions to the killing of Ahmaud Arbery and also about their experiences and the exhaustive mental checklists that they sometimes have to go through to ensure their safety for fear of discrimination. We've been talking with Kurt Streeter, who covers sports for the New York Times, Eric McDuffie, a runner in Urbana, who's also a professor of African American studies at the University of Illinois, and Maria Stanfield, who's an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Helen Neville is a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. She's also the current president-elect of the Society for the Psychological Study of Culture, Ethnicity, and Race, which is a division of the American Psychological Association. Professor Neville, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me to talk about this incredibly important topic.
Yeah, so as we've been talking about, there's this idea out there that running or taking a walk outside is a healthy and relaxing activity, and it's supposed to be one of the few safe things people can do at this time of pandemic. But obviously people of color have what Kurt referred to in his article as this exhaustive mental checklist before going out. And this is not just about running. This is something that some people say they feel every time they leave the house, they have to think about these things. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what kind of effect that can have on a person.
Sure. I think a lot of what you're talking about is what psychologists, in particular Robert Carter and other psychologists, talk about as racial trauma. And this is really this emotional and physical responses to encounters with white racial violence or anti-Black racism is what we're talking about now. So this idea about this exhaustive mental checklist is really this response to racial trauma. And these racial trauma, can be linked to people's individual experiences. So you had the three runners talk about their own individual experiences, but it also can be, this trauma can come from, it could be vicarious. So like for all of us who have to see on the news every night, the killing of Black men and Black women, that can be traumatic as well, because these folks represent our communities and what happened to them is so atrocious. And so dealing with this racial kind of trauma, these emotional consequences to these disturbing events. And so what is that like mental, that exhaustive mental checklist? What does that look like? What kind of impact does it have? How does it show up in our everyday lives? It can show up like feeling tense or anxious, tearing up frequently, lacking concentration, having a hard time relaxing, having anger outbursts, having a hard time concentrating, can't stop thinking about the events, having trouble sleeping, having problems with our digestive system, feeling it in our bodies. So while we experience these traumas, we can't just leave them and in this little silo, they stay with us often. I think that's important. There's a scholar, William Smith at Utah University, that talks about this idea about racial battle fatigue. So it's this, when they talk about exhaustive mental checklists, this is really a reflection of this racial battle fatigue, where people are exposed to these chronic kind of racial stressors, anti-Blackness, racial violence, where it builds up resentment, maybe even people withdrawing from a social situation, feeling just worn out from all the day-to-day racism. And so that's the way that it shows up in us. What hasn't been talked about in terms of just this, the impact that it has, is what impact does this have on our children, particularly African-American children, who hear about this, who see this? Obviously, we tried to shelter folks, or we tried to kind of, explain it. But experiences with white racism and racial violence is terrifying for youth. I'll give you just one example. I took our granddaughter, who lives with us, was 12 at the time. We went hiking in a beautiful little area that's about 30 minutes away from Champaign-Urbana. And I decided to treat her and one of her friends to lunch. And we stop off at this little diner. It was really cute. But my granddaughter was raised in Georgia, much like the place where, when we're talking about Ahmed Arbery. And she's like, I don't feel safe in this little town. I don't want to go into the restaurant. So I convinced her to go in. And for the entire time that she's eating, she's telling me how scared she is, how she doesn't know what's going to happen, how they don't stop off in towns like this in Georgia. And she was so worked up that after we ate and were leaving, she was vomiting. So this idea of what we're experiencing, it's impacting our youth too, because they don't have some of the coping mechanisms that we have built up over time.
Wow, that is such a powerful story. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. And it reminds me that, Kurt, in your piece for the New York Times, you write that you've been running with your son. Do you talk about these dangers with him? Can you talk about that experience?
I'm very careful with that. And just as the professor was noting, I mean, I'm very aware of that and worried about the trauma and how he perceives these risks and him taking on these fears, how he will handle that. He's 9 years old. And we really, during the pandemic, we started running as our way to like kind of end days, or about 5 o'clock after his, all of his school Zoom calls and all that. And so it's been a great way for us to bond. A lot of times, as he's grown up, we've talked a lot about race. He's in an unusual situation because, he's not raised around a lot of Black folks other than his family. And he's also extremely light, light skin tone. So he may end up experiencing the world quite a bit differently than I do. But as we, so it's all, in other words, it's always on our plate. It's always something mm-hmm. that we talk about, but we talk about it very cautiously and carefully.
And
regarding the, you know, the killings, and I basically have avoided exactly telling him what's happened, the worst that can happen, because I don't want to freak him out about running. There's a neighborhood near us that's really white and really exclusive, and I don't really feel comfortable there. I've just told him, Dad doesn't want to go jog there, you know, for now. I've sort of had it with that place, as nice as it is, but it's his favorite route. So it's a little bit hard. You know, he doesn't quite get that. Why, you know, and I've told him, I've just said, you know, not a lot of people like us there, and I don't feel that comfortable with us being there. And I've sort of left it at that. So yeah. It's a tough thing. It's a really tricky thing. That trauma that the professor talked about is very, very real. Definitely.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That's Kurt Streeter. He covers sports at the New York Times. We're also speaking with Professor Helen Neville. She's a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois. Professor Eric McDuffie, who's a runner in Urbana and also a professor of African American studies at the University of Illinois. And Maria Stanfield, an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. And Maria, I wonder if you can talk about that idea of children and, you know, getting children involved in the activity of running. I mean, it's a big thing. We're told to promote healthy youth, but I mean, do you have concerns about that? Do you share the, or do you see the sense of fear among younger people that we've been talking about?
Well, I am a mother. My children are adults now. My son is 21 and my daughter is 25, but my son, wrestled for Michigan State University and has been an all-state athlete. And my daughter played basketball for many years. And wrestling is a sport that takes you traveling all around the country as well. So I have seen, and he plays football, I have seen my children be privy to racism around the globe on numerous occasions. Now, when it comes to running, I have volunteered with a local organization called Girls on the Run. And when you talk about running with children, and it's more like a controlled environment. Oftentimes there's a track involved. It's not as broad unless you're running with a team, and there are several youth running teams, but it's not as broad as some of the exposure that we as adults are privy to. And I think that it's up to us also to guard our children and have responsible conversations about some of the trauma and the atrocities that are taking place as it pertains to African-American men and women, because we don't want to increase their anxieties or their exposure to adverse experiences. They're going to experience some of those experiences no matter what, because of the media they see them. So if you see them, you can't hold your head in the sand. But we do have a responsibility as adults and parents to protect them as much as we can as well. That doesn't mean that we don't let them know the dangers that society faces, but it does mean that we don't further traumatize them by exposing them.
And Eric, I wonder where. Yeah, yeah. Eric, I wonder where you are on this question. I understand you have some young children yourself.
Yes. I mean, this is a very, very tough question. You know, how do you balance sharing or having very tough conversations about racial violence while at the same time not trying to traumatize your children? So my daughter's 16. She has started to run by herself. And of course, I'm concerned about her and her well-being out there. And my son is going on 12. Even just before all the stuff that's happened, you know, I and their mother always talked with them about possibilities of being attacked, the importance of being aware of their surroundings. But I've also talked with my neighbors, most of whom are white, and I've asked them if they could be safe houses. So in the event that my kids are walking or running through the neighborhood and they feel unsafe, if they feel like they're being chased, they're being stalked, that they can go to these homes and be safe in the event that they feel like their life is at risk, or if they feel like they are threatened. But this is something that I think about all the time, and just the fact that I go out and that I will go out this weekend, and I think my daughter might actually be listening to this as we speak. You know, certainly I'm going to have a conversation with them about this.
And I'm afraid we only have about a minute and a half left in our conversation. And Professor Neville, I want to end with you. And I know this is a big question, but I wonder what, you know, we've seen these acts of solidarity after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. People around the country, you know, running 2.23 miles, wearing a white T-shirt. But, you know, beyond social media posts and simple acts like that, what are some of the biggest things that people, and especially white people, can do on an individual level or an institutional level to stop incidents like the one we saw in Central Park or the killing of Ahmaud Arbery?
Great. Thanks for that. I'll try to wrap this up, but I do have one quick point that as a follow-up to our previous discussion.
Sure.
When you do talk about these racial incidents with children, it's also important to talk about racial cultural advancement and accomplishments and contributions so that kids just don't get an image that Black folks are people that are oppressed and are survivors of racial violence, but they also have contributed intellectually, culturally to society.
That's
so
a great point.
We have to give messages of cultural pride. In terms of,
and I'm afraid we just have about 30 seconds. So
okay, yeah. What can folks do? One is educate themselves and continue to educate themselves about what's going on, to begin to explore the root causes of these. These aren't just isolated incidences; that they are linked to a systematic form of racism, structural racism, and white supremacy. So educate and don't stray away from that. Read, learn. And then once they are educated, to take action, to identify those organizations that are doing some really good work in this area. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, they can either contribute money or just show up in other ways. So
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Helen Neville is a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois. We've also been speaking with Kurt Streeter of the New York Times and Eric McDuffie, professor of African American studies at the University of Illinois, and Maria Stanfield, ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. Thank you all so much for being here. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.